Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And I am thrilled to be here, and it's a privilege to be invited to come spend the weekend with you guys, and Connie and I are both very grateful for that opportunity, and we've had a terrific time. Your speakers have been wonderful. I got to tell you, I was standing in the back before the meeting, and a woman came up. I was with last night's speaker, Butch. Butch and I were talking, and she was saying, you know, it has just been, she says, each speaker, Madeline and Cliff and Larsine and Butch have built on, it's just gotten better and better, and I'm just higher and higher, and I'm here to prove the old adage that what goes up must come down, and I want to lower the bar for the rest of your speakers this weekend. You know, I'm a little under the weather, and I went around back behind the curtain, and I caught myself praying, and I was praying, I was saying, asking God to kind of help me feel better, help me get through this, okay? Then I was sitting here and looking out at the audience, and see, I forgot what my job was. My job is not for me to look good, but my job is to just share my experience, strength, and hope. Years ago, I'd left a meeting in Richmond, Virginia, that I'd been asked to speak at a little group when I lived there. I was about 3 years sober, and I just stumbled and bumbled my way all the way through it, as I may today with the way that I feel. But I got home, and I called my sponsor, Joe, and I said, Joe, I just don't think I did a very good job tonight. And he said, well, Steve, you're starting from a false premise. He says, because that implies there's a night you think you did do a good job. And he said, it is not up to you to do a good job or a bad job. It is up to you to go do what you were invited to do to the best of your ability on that given day. So you'll get my best today. I called Connie about a year ago. It was April about a year ago from a conference I'd been at. And I said, same thing. I called her that evening after I had talked. And I said, man, I don't think I gave a good talk tonight. And she says, well, I hope you weren't talking. I hope God was. And I said, well, in the hospitality room, they're blaming me for God's talk. So later, when you chat amongst yourselves, remember. I'm gonna try to share with you what my life was like. You know, and what I was like, and what happened to kind of bump me towards Alcoholics Anonymous, and what's been going on since I've been here, and I think that my perspective has changed over the years. I mean, it was when I said that I'm going to tell you what I was like, and the fact is that is probably not true. I'm going to tell you my perception of what I was like. I'm going to tell you what my alcoholism looked like and felt like from the inside out. And even as I tell you what's going on today, it will be my experience. It won't necessarily, what I've discovered over the years is that often other people were having a different experience than I was at the same time I was going through something. So I'm sharing a perspective, and that's really one of the things that happens for a guy like me at Alcoholics Anonymous is my perspective changes. And when we get spiritually awakened, one of the results of that is I begin to see the world as it really is. And I begin to see me as I really am, or certainly more accurately. And over time, as Chuck C. talks about that new pair of glasses, over time through the process of these steps and the continuous action and application, maybe that prescription gets dialed in a little finer all the time, and I begin to see things perhaps as they really are. I know that my perception can be off because a number of years ago I was going to a conference in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and I had never met my host. We had spoken on the phone a number of times before getting there, and he was going to meet me, obviously, and I was down in the baggage area, and we just couldn't connect. You know, we couldn't find each other, and I'm on my cell phone finally calling him, And he said, Steve, I'm right over here by baggage claim number 6. I said, you can't be, man. I'm at baggage claim number 6. And he said, no, I'm right here, right now. And we started looking around, and finally we made contact. And we realized the reason we'd had such a hard time finding each other is we'd both described ourselves as much more attractive than we really are. So how I see me is not always how other people see me. And that's true literally, and it's true figuratively. It's true that I don't see the whole picture, and you don't see the whole picture. You will know me better. You will know more about me when I get off of this off this stage and away from this podium, but there'll be a lot that you don't know. I'm going to be honest with you today, but I'm often honestly mistaken. I sometimes suffer from a past that never actually happened. Connie, more than once, and we've talked about it this weekend with some other people, more than once, after a talk, she will share with me, not to correct me, but just an observational way, that I will have described an event that she remembers quite differently. And I'm not making it up. I'm just telling you that this is what it felt like to me. I'll get on with it and share a little bit. I'll start with the sobriety date. I've got one of those, and it's June the 30th of 1989. And my I've got a home group, the backroom group of Alcoholics Anonymous, meets every Saturday and Sunday morning. They met this morning in my absence. It hardly seemed worth it, but I'm sure there was a murmur of excitement as they looked around, and I wasn't there, and some sharing time opened up for someone. So I told you my sobriety date was June the 30th of 1989, so I'll tell you about what's always the most embarrassing thing I share from the podium, and it's June the 29th of 1989, which is the last time I've had a drink. And I don't know if it's my last drink, but it's the last one I've had, and I can promise you I did not anticipate going from that day until this between drinks. And but I was scheduled into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. And I wasn't going in because I wanted to stop drinking or thought I needed to stop drinking. I wasn't going in because I'd had some epiphany. I wasn't going in because I thought my life needed or required some moral reconstruct. I was going simply to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my sixth DUI a year prior. And as a result of that that conviction, we had actually done a plea bargain agreement, and the plea bargain agreement was gave me some jail time and shaved some of that jail time off under the condition that I would go to inpatient drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And I certainly heard the word rehab, but I really didn't have any clue what that was going to be like or what to expect. I didn't think it was fair. I certainly, I didn't think that my crime warranted such a punitive action. I had left a bar in Brentwood, Tennessee. I'd gone in around 6:30 in the evening that previous March, and I went. You ever go in and go into a restaurant around 6:30 and it turns into a bar around 9, and I left around midnight, and I went the wrong way down the little street, and I hit a Brentwood police officer going the wrong way down the street, and that will get you arrested in Brentwood. And I came to in the Williamson County Jail the next morning. I was dressed much like I am this morning, and I still had my tie firmly and knotted up against my shirt, and an alcoholic will take his props wherever he can get them, and I was voted best dressed in the drunk tank that morning. And I called Connie, not the first time I'd called her from jail, but I called Connie from jail that morning, and she suggested I call someone else. And her mother had come to, since first time her mother had come to stay with us since we had been married, and I was in jail, didn't come home, ended up in jail. Guy came, bailed me out a little later that day, and by 1 o'clock that afternoon, I was in a lawyer's office, and he said to me something I don't recall being asked before. Now, again, it may have come up, but I don't remember being asked. He said, "Steve, do you think you've got a problem with alcohol?" And I said, "You know what, pal? What I think I got's a legal problem." And I wish you would focus all your time and attention on this legal dilemma I've got, and, you know, save the sermon for another day. And he said he would, and he did. He went to work, you know. He went to work. Now, after about 90 days, I think it was, is when we ultimately ended up going to court and doing through the plea bargain agreement. And then ultimately, it's a year later, they were trying to put me in jail for a year because I'd had these multiple DUIs and I'd had them in different states. And I typically totaled an automobile when I had these wrecks. I totaled 6 cars. I had a lot of other cars that just, I'm a drunk that got in the car and went somewhere, you know, and I say that, you know, I'll tell a couple of stories about that before this morning's over, but I want to make sure that I say while I'm thinking about it, you don't get in a crowd of this size or almost any size of alcoholics and friends and families of alcoholics that someone's life hasn't been irreparably damaged by a drunken driver. So I don't take that lightly for a moment. I absolutely don't. But when I get on the other side of my escapades, which is a very kind word that our book gives for what we do, it almost sounds like icecapades, and says our various escapades before and after. These escapades, were dotted with these different car wrecks, and sometimes I just hit poles and signs and parked cars, and there goes a tail light, and there goes a bumper, and you know, just tacky. You know, there's some big stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. There really are. You've heard some this weekend. And often we frame our stories from the podium around those most colorful escapades, and rightly so. But, you know, for a great many of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, the real life of the alcoholic is often just a day-by-day, tacky, tawdry life of little lies and dinging away at the people we love the most and inch by inch and brick by brick giving up our integrity and our moral code. And it sometimes happens so slowly and imperceptibly that I move with it until I can go no lower. And I hurt the people around me and don't know I'm doing it. And then I do know that I'm doing it and promise not to do it again. And I do it again. And I don't know that I can't help myself. I don't know what my problem is, and I certainly don't know what the solution is. So that day in that courtroom in Williamson County when we cut the plea bargain, he came out and actually said, "Steve, here's the deal." He was very pleased with the deal he cut, and he was almost skipping down the hall. He said, "You just have to do 60 days in jail." And I'm telling you, man, I'm not a tough guy. I'm not a street smart guy. I'm just a poster boy for middle-class alcoholism. And I said, man, I don't have the skill sets for jail. Would you go talk to them one more time? And he did, and I'll be forever grateful. He went and came back, and he said, okay, he said, here's the deal, good as it's going to get. Do 10 weekends in jail. And go to drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And I said, yes. And now this year was almost up. I'm scheduled to go in on July the 1st, June the 29th. Connie and I go out with 3 other couples, just kind of a last hurrah before I'm going away. So this wasn't the drunk to end all drunks. It's just I didn't know it was going to be my last drink for 25 years. Because what I'm humiliated to share with you this morning is that my last drink was an amaretto on the rocks. Had I dreamt I would be retelling that story over and over, I promise you I would have had something else. This would be a more colorful story. They said, "Steve, we had a little meeting and you can have one more drink. What will it be?" Amaretto would not have made my top 10. But we came home from dinner. I had that amaretto. I smoked a joint. I went to bed. We got up the next day. Connie and I were going to spend that day, June the 30th, with our daughter Abby, who was then 5 years old, before Daddy was going away on a 28-day business trip. And we took Abby to Chuck E. Cheese. I share with you, if you're new or if you are not yet here, I'm not a tough guy, clearly, but do not spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese. It was a hellish day at Chuck E. Cheese. Because, you know, they are short and snare, and they're just coming at you from every angle, and it's loud, and just as I'm gathering my emotional balance, I saw a 6-foot mouse, and I said to Connie, you know, baby, do you see the mouse? And next day, my friend Ricky comes by to pick me up July the 1st of 89 to drive me off to this treatment facility called the Harbors of Brentwood. It was just a few miles from our home. Connie walked out. I get the kind of support from Connie that a lot of my AA brothers and sisters didn't get. As we walked out to the car and I'm leaving, her parting words to me were, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking. And, you know, go do your time. Go do what you got to do, you know. But don't drink the Kool-Aid." And because Connie and I met, we met in a bar. We met over a pile of cocaine that was hers. I was immediate. You can see the attraction. And it's not that we didn't care and love for one. We grew. We certainly had a you know, we fell in love. But we fell in love. We came together based on a commonality that after a while was not going to serve us well. But at that point, it was not like stop. Now here's, look, I will promise you, and you can talk to her later, I'm sure that she wished she had a little more control over my drinking and my behavior, when I drank it, who I drank it with, stuff like that. But stopping altogether to no one in my life seemed like the answer to the problem. See, I had alcohol-related problems. I mean, I can connect those dots and see that I have problems that seem to be caused by me getting drunk. But stopping drinking altogether hardly ever seemed like the solution to that problem. I'm trying to do what our book says without knowing what our book says, is my great obsession was to control and enjoy my drinking. And to control and enjoy my drinking on a guy like me does not mean don't get drunk. I mean, when I drink, I want to get drunk. I just don't want to get too drunk. I just want to get just the right amount drunk. And the right amount drunk is to get everything that alcohol does for me without suffering the pains of what it did to me. You know, back in A Vision for You, it talks about, you know, as Butch, what a wonderful talk Butch gave last night. I told him, I said, I was both encouraged and discouraged by his talk. I was encouraged because we're such close, dear friends, and I have such a great respect for him that I'm always encouraged when I hear someone like Butch share in a way that I so identify with and that seems to match my sensibilities. I was discouraged that he got a chance to tell you those things first. Back in A Vision for You, and Butch talked last night about what that drink feels like, right? That ah moment. In A Vision for You, it talks about what most normal folks get from a few drinks. It says, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, joyous intimacy with friends, colorful imagination, release from care, boredom, and worry, and a feeling that life is good. I just got a little thirsty right then saying that. That's an attractive package. And it says, you know, that's most normal folks. It says, but not for a guy like me in the latter days of my drinking. That's not what I get in the latter days. It says maybe momentarily. So maybe on that fourth drink that Butch talked about last night, on that fourth drink when all's right, everything clicks in, there's that moment. But I drink through that moment. And then comes oblivion and awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. See, I just wanted a little joyous intimacy with friends, and I wake up with these four bastards. Where did you guys come from, and how are we getting out of this mess? And that, you know, and it is, I mean, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. How did I get here again? How did I do this to me again? How did I do this to them again? Is this ever going to stop? Now, the people around me, again, weren't telling me to stop drinking. Back in our book, in To the Employer, there's a wonderful line. It says, when dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance that someone could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. See, people were telling me in one way or another that I was weak, stupid, and irresponsible. People weren't telling me to stop drinking. They were telling me don't drink so much, don't drink so often, don't drink it there, don't drink it with them, don't drink it tonight. They weren't telling me not to drink. They were telling me to grow up, be a man, be responsible, be a husband, be a father, go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Still one of my biggest challenges. So I don't understand. You know, sometimes when we talk from the podium, and if you're new, it sounds like maybe a guy like me knew what was going on, because it sounds like maybe I was having these types of thoughts as I was going through it. I wasn't. Life was just happening to me. You know, my friend Bob says life is fired at point-blank range, and I'm just responding to it, and I can't think and articulate what's going on. I don't understand my problem. I don't have language to describe how I feel, even when sober. I don't understand what's wrong with me, what's wrong with life, why I do this. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys gave voice to my alcoholism. When I'm in that treatment center, and we're going out to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people are bringing meetings in, and in fairness, we went to a variety of 12-step programs that were all welcoming and encouraging. And I began to hear you share your stories. I began to read in our book, and I would see something, and once I saw it, I would realize, that's it. That's it. And I didn't know it a moment before, but as soon as you said it or I read it, it resonated in a way that I knew this had been true forever about me. You began to articulate for me that which I couldn't express myself. One of the places where it does that is... You know, so in 1980, I'm going to tell you everything that happened before got me here and after, but I just don't promise to do it in order. There's no chronological continuum in this story I'm going to tell. There'll just be a series of unrelated stories that hopefully make sense by the end of the hour, and I'll stop on time whether I'm done or not. But all of this stuff is happening, and I can't articulate it. So in 1980, I'm living in Atlanta, Georgia. I go to a bar one afternoon. I'm throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking Tylenols and barbiturates. And I leave there, and somehow disoriented, I get on I-285 in Atlanta going east in the westbound lane. I hit a car head-on. Two other cars hit us. It totaled all four cars. It sent people to the hospital. It sent me to jail. I came to the next morning in that Fulton County jail. I'd urinated on myself and I'd vomited on myself, or I hope I did, because somebody did. See, I'm a blackout drinker, it's not a big deal. It doesn't require much for me to blackout. You don't have to be a blackout drinker to be alcoholic, but I love what... Dave Attell, the comedian, says, he said he's a blackout drinker, or as he likes to call it, time travel. And that's the way it often felt to me, you know, where you just go, whoa, you know, how did I get here in the future, and what has been going on? And you try to fill in those blanks by not asking direct questions, you know, just kind of reading people's faces and wondering how it went. Was I just kind of cute last night, or did it go way off in the weeds, right? Anyway, I come to in that jail cell that morning in that state, and I was as afraid as I had ever been of the consequences that awaited me legally, personally, professionally. I was as ashamed as I had ever been at the harm I'd caused other people. I didn't yet know the extent of the injuries. They turned out not to be critical or fatal. I was sued over it later, as I should have been. I was as humiliated as I had ever been at the state I found myself in, my own urine and my own vomit. And I was as certain as I had ever been that I'll never drink again. I had now crossed a line that that even I can't live with. I'm done. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road, smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking I nearly overreacted to that. And that's the alcoholism that I have. And then I get to AA and I see in our book where it says there'll come a time that a guy like me won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'll be without defense. See, it seems like, but my experience tells me, I mean, I'm a, you know, my mother told me I was a bright guy. I'm not sure she was right, but she kept saying I was, and she couldn't figure out why a guy like me would keep doing these things again. And she was a drinker. But see, why would you drink and drink? You know, you get that first DUI, you get that second DUI. Steve, why would you do that again? Why would you drink and drive? Well, mother, I wasn't going to, but then I got drunk. When I get drunk, I change my mind about stuff. And it doesn't feel like lack of power. I don't know. See, I don't know that I've got this alcoholism that brings with it this physical allergy, this phenomenon of craving is the language you began to give me, where I'm unpredictable. I don't know that. I was never out in the bar, you know, and after about the third drink, poked the guy next to me and said, whoa, I don't know about you, pal, but that phenomenon of craving's kicking in on me. Well, lack of power is my dilemma. You know, I did not. I just said, hey, I'll just have another one. I'll just stay longer. Oh, to hell with them. To hell with it. To heck with work. I know I'm supposed to be somewhere. It felt like I changed my mind. So Ricky's driving me over to the treatment center, back at the ranch, and he pulls up, and they give me a test almost immediately. A lot of you have had a version of this. They call it an assessment. These have changed a little bit over the years. Now they are more insurance-driven around meeting certain medical criteria. But this was kind of those tests we see in magazines and that, you know, sort of like the Jeff Foxworthy, you might be a redneck if, and these were kind of the you might be an alcoholic if, I guess, but it said, have you ever drank, you know, 30 questions. Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had a blackout? You know, 30, have you ever questions? They said, by the way, Steve, have you ever means even once, and even with a really good reason. Have you ever? And they just got check yes or no to what I contend are clearly SA questions. Yeah. Because these are questions that beg for an explanation. And again, you know, we laugh here, and I want us to have a good time this morning, but I don't ever want the message to get lost in the laughter. And we laugh here because we're looking back, and I can begin to see the absurdity of my life as I was living it. And I can, but that morning, there was nothing funny going on that morning. And as I'm looking at those questions, and I'm seeing that box, check yes or check no, and I know that somebody's going to draw conclusions about me based on looking at this checked box. And they don't know the backstory. They don't have the context. They can't understand. Let me explain myself. Have you ever drank in the morning? I mean, I got questions about the questions. What do you mean morning? And I think it's a valid question because, see, one of my problems is I think I know what they're asking. See, I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got, you know, come to at 4:30 in the morning and reach over off the nightstand and grab that, you know, hot half pint of whiskey and take a pull on it just to be able to get to the bathroom. But what if it's 2 a.m. and I'm out at a nice establishment somewhere at last call? Is that morning drinking? And if I just check yes, you don't know the distinction between me and that reprobate. Because I think there's a distinction. Have you ever drank alone? You know, well, you know, yeah, but they left. Well, whoa, you know, where did everybody go? We started this party together. But see, I think I know what they're asking. I think they're asking if I'm that guy that's got to, you know, go home with a bottle and close the door and pull the blinds and turn the lights down and used to be unplugged the phone, but now just turn it off and hide from the world and drink in isolation. And I've done that a few times, but not so often I'm checking it on this test. And but see, there's another kind of alone drinking that a guy like me, you know, I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking. So if I'm having a few drinks at home, getting ready to go, is that alone drinking? I said, what if I'm in the car driving over there drinking, but there are other cars on the road? Is that alone drinking? You know, in the back of our book, in the story Freedom from Bondage, she describes rationalization. And she says rationalization is giving a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior. And isn't this a form of insanity? And see, that's what I was trying to do. Unknowingly, I've spent a lot of my life trying to provide an acceptable explanation for behavior that's unacceptable. I'm trying to create the backstory that makes this palatable to those at first, to those around me. But in the latter years of my drinking, I'm having to tell me a story to help me live with me being the person I had become. And it gets harder and harder to buy that story. That rationalization gets hard. I'm going to go back and drink a little bit more, and then I'm going to sober up for a while. I grew up in Smyrna, Tennessee, small town, good family, you know, middle class family, no big deal, nothing special, but there didn't seem to be anything really chaotic going on at our house. You know, nobody was hitting anybody, and, you know, my mother and dad were together. My dad traveled for business a lot. They were drinkers, but it didn't seem like a big thing to me. I didn't think about alcohol a lot. I didn't think about their drinking of it or not drinking of it. I was a good kid. I went where I said I was going to go. I was with who I said I was going to be with. I came home when I said I was going to come home. I made a decision in school. I was playing athletics and made a decision that I wasn't going to drink or smoke, you know. And not for some big high moral deal. I just wasn't going to do it. I really don't remember kind of the thought behind that decision. But I knew it wasn't challenging for me. The decision came easily, and the execution of that decision came easily. And our book says that if a mere code of morals and philosophy of living were sufficient, that many of us would have recovered long ago. And I will tell you that my code of morals and my philosophy of living were sufficient right up to the moment they were no longer sufficient. They work right up till they don't work. And I don't see that coming. And I don't know what it was. I was a freshman in college, and two buddies came by to pick me up to go to a basketball game, and I got in the back seat of a 1968 yellow Volkswagen Bug, and they handed back a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine. You know, that ticks me off when you do that. No, really, this AA is the damnedest place I've ever been. I mean, because you guys are, you tell your stories, right? Oh, I robbed 7 banks, and I'm married to 3 women in 2 states, but, I didn't drink to Boone's Farm. No. But I know so far that Boone's Farm, Amaretta, and Chuck E. Cheese has got me no street cred in this crowd. I know that. And I will tell you, I used to pump this story up a little bit, you know, in an effort to help you. But here's what I've discovered over time. What I've discovered over time is our book says we tell the new man exactly what happened to us. And see, what I know is my story doesn't resonate with everyone. And your story will not resonate with everyone, which is why all of us need to tell our story. All of us, whether it's from the podium, whether it's in our home groups, whether it's a cup of coffee, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic sharing with another, telling the truth about ourselves to the best of our ability. for me to shy away from something that happened would be a disservice to you and AA and me. And to make up something that didn't, it would be the same disservice. So I got Chuck E. Cheese, Amaretta, and Boone's Farm. But there were a few more escapades in there. But these guys, finally, they passed that back. And the memory that I have was that I was in the back seat, and all of a sudden, I just couldn't wait to get where we were going. Because I thought the people there couldn't wait to see me when we got there. And I wanted to spring myself on an unsuspecting world. And all of a sudden, the back seat of that Volkswagen couldn't hold me. And that feeling, it was a wonderful feeling. I passed out that night. I blacked out. I don't have a memory of it. I came to the next morning at home. I was living at home with my mom in my mom's house. And my clothes were neatly folded next to the bed. So I knew that I did not do it. On a sober, I didn't do that. So I knew I didn't do it that night. Now, I don't know if I was alcoholic just after I took that drink of Boone's Farm. I don't know if I was alcoholic before I took that drink. And I don't know at what point I became alcoholic. I cannot confirm for you when that happened. Because I don't know if I drank alcoholically from that moment on, because I drank so enthusiastically from that moment on. And it is impossible for me to tell if I can control or moderate my drinking if I'm not trying to control or moderate it. And it's impossible for me to know whether I could have stopped and never started again because I didn't try to stop. And our book says, in the doctor's opinion, that while they have no way of proving it, they believe that many of them could have stopped early in their drinking careers. And the reason they have no way of proving it is because, like me, they did not try it. There is no proof, because why would a guy like me not drink the next day, given what I got that night? Why would I not do that again? And there began to be a price to pay right away. Certainly there were consequences from my drinking, but they were a small price to pay for what I was getting. Because when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you help me begin to see that my real problem is that selfishness and self-centeredness that it at the root, that self-centered fear is the root of my problem, and I pour some alcohol on that, and it disappears. It doesn't disappear. It's masked. It's covered up. It doesn't go anywhere. But for a little while, I don't know it's there. And see, I did not know that I needed that drink so badly until after I took it. And I didn't know until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I was alcoholic. Even once I get to AA, that I'm alcoholic even when I'm not drinking. See, all of these problems, again, just a host of a long list of tacky behavior and car wrecks and not living up to my responsibilities as a husband and a father and a son, and you just name it. I fall short in every area of my life in some way. Often there were drinking-related escapades that you could tie to that, but what I couldn't figure out, so I know I got alcohol-related problems, but what I can't figure out is why on a Tuesday afternoon with a wife that loved me and a kid that loved me and a pretty good job and a home and two cars, why did I feel like I felt? And why did I feel in a way that I could not articulate or describe to anyone else? I would never have this conversation with somebody else. I couldn't explain how I felt. I couldn't explain why when I went to work in our company business that was a sales business and I was traveling throughout the rural South in Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia, going to call on little rural furniture stores to sell our wares. And people had told me I was going to be good at that. I had a pretty good I'd been pretty average at everything up to then. I wasn't a good student. I wasn't bad. I just kind of coasted on everything. But they said, this is where he's going to shine. Steve's going to be great at this. And I would wander into these little towns, and I couldn't go in. And I couldn't make that sales call, and I would sit in my car. And sometimes I would go from this town to the next town and sit in my car and not go in there either. And then sometimes I'd wait till the guy in those little towns, usually the guy who ran the store owned the store. And I'd see him leave and go to lunch, and I would go in and ask for him. And then I'd leave my card and say, well, tell him I was by. And I can't explain why I was so deathly afraid to make those sales calls. And I would go back to the motel room at night, to little traveler's lodge that guys like me would stay in, and drink and smoke dope all night and you know, determine that I was going to do better tomorrow and get up the next day and just not be able to do it. I can't explain why I couldn't do that, and I couldn't tell anybody I couldn't do that. And I went over 2 years doing that, you know, probably made half a dozen sales calls in 2 years. They began to notice that I wasn't really that good at this job. So finally, I just quit it and ran away to Florida. I was working for my brother. I thought it was all his fault. I blamed him for years. For years, I said my brother was the most complicated relationship in my life. And I was 18 years sober before I realized I was the complication. Well into my sobriety, I was the complication. And I put him in jail for crimes I perceived that he committed years before, long after the statute of limitations should have run out, when he was a 22, 23-year-old kid, 25-year-old kid himself, trying to give direction to a 21-year-old kid out there working when neither of us knew what we were doing. But he became the patriarch of our family, he was the financial benefactor in our family, and that's a lot of responsibility. But all I saw was some guy trying to tell me what to do and not understanding. You'll be glad to know that I have 28 minutes left. And I'm about to bring the good stuff here in a few minutes. All of those things I couldn't explain. Sober, the sober feelings. So in that treatment center, and two men from Alcoholics Anonymous came in about the third night I was there, and they did what Alcoholics Anonymous suggests that we do. They came in as ex-problem drinkers in whom the problem had been solved, properly armed with the facts about themselves. And because I'd spent a lot of time in that treatment center defending myself from the charge of alcoholism. I felt like I didn't want to be alcoholic. I wasn't ready to be alcoholic. I'd come to determine I really didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I was pretty sure if you said out loud you were one, that somebody was going to suggest you not drink anything at all. And that was an overcorrection to the problem that I showed up with. So I called myself a problem drinker while I was there. And we went out to meetings, and I would be a problem drinker. And you know what? People told me that was perfectly okay. I'm really glad that the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to be in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to learn what Alcoholics Anonymous is. That you didn't expect me to show up knowing the rules of the game. Now, people, I think as Butch said last night, some people would take me aside and help me understand some things, help me understand about behavior, help me understand that it would be polite to, sit through the whole meeting to the extent that I could or not be a disruptive force. But Pete, there was no finger wagging at me that I noticed. And I felt welcome, and what I thought I was hearing was that nothing was required of me in AA. And believe me, that, and when I say required, that I got to come and hang out and participate at whatever level I chose to. And you know what? That was comforting to me because I wanted to audit the class. I want to come in and hang around because I didn't want to be there at all, but I had to. So I'm going to be there. I'm not the guy that raised his hand when they said, are there any newcomers here? I didn't raise my hand. I didn't want three people with pamphlets showing up at my house on Tuesday, you know. I didn't know how it worked, but you guys allowed me to find my way, and it was by listening to you that I began that miracle and that linchpin of Alcoholics Anonymous, the identification one alcoholic with another began to happen to me and for me. Anyway, those guys just shared about themselves. They said, look, so I could listen to them. They said, we're not here on a membership drive. We're not here trying to convince anybody to be alcoholic. We're just going to share a little bit about our experience. And they began to do that. And in about 3 weeks into that being in treatment, I finally said I was an alcoholic. And I still promise you I didn't know quite what I was copping to, but I was willing to say out loud I'm alcoholic. And I did know that meant that people were going to suggest I not drink. And like Butch said last night, I think, while you were saying stuff like a day at a time, I really knew that the goal was not to drink a day at a time forever. And that the decision that I make in the first step, if I read our book correctly, is that I can never drink safely again. So I'm making a concession that I can never drink again safely. I execute my decision a day at a time. But that surrender I made at the first step ultimately was I'm done. And I'm going to try to stay done one day at a time. But I didn't know anything about this unmanageability of my life. I didn't understand that I had alcoholism when I wasn't drinking. I didn't understand that thing that I really thought was different about me, how I felt, how I saw the world, how I experienced it, that was common to alcoholics. You know, the book says that the phenomenon of craving, this physical allergy to alcohol, is the single symptom that we all have in common. It says that's where, regardless of our personality types, regardless of our age, regardless of anything else, this physical allergy is the common denominator. And it's exclusive to alcoholics. Apparently, if you don't have that, you're not alcoholic. Doesn't make you a bad person. Just means you're not alcoholic. The second part of the first step suggests that my life is unmanageable. Now that is common to the alcoholic, but it's not exclusive to the alcoholic. There's over 200 other 12-step programs that have unmanageability, in their first step. I listened to Larsine talk yesterday. Look, we are different personality types. She doesn't have the allergy to alcohol, but man, Larsine and I have a lot in common. The unmanageability of my life is described in our book, among other places, on page 52, where it talks about my human problems. And they are the bedevilments and an inability to control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, can't be of real use to other people, bouts of fear, feelings of uselessness. I had no idea those feelings that I had that I was walking around with. I might have labeled them a little differently than those words, but I had no idea that's part of my alcoholism, that actually I pour alcohol on that to feel better. Not consciously. I didn't walk around saying that. But see, what I don't believe that most of the people in my life would have described me as insecure and lonely and shy and use those types of words, because I worked very hard not to let you see me feeling that way. Yet I was uncomfortable in the company of a lot of people. I know I would stand outside sometimes going into a social event. And if I hadn't had enough to drink yet, I'm getting ready to go in and I've got to steel myself up. I got to get ready to go in. And then I show up in there ready to play. I'm the dancing bear. I do what's expected of me, what I think's expected of me. And I give it this whole night, and then I walk back out the door and get in my car and can finally relax and quit acting. So another place where the book described me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was over around the fourth step, when it says that the alcoholic, more than most, is an actor. And it's a stage character that he wants his fellows to see. He wants to be a man of certain reputation, but in his heart he knows he doesn't deserve it. And that's the way I had been living my life. I desperately wanted to win your approval, or at least be noticed. And I wanted it to be positive. But even when I got that and you patted me on the back, I thought you were responding to the fraud. It left me empty. Connie and I had been married. We'd been married about almost 10 years. We'd been sober. Connie's sobriety date, by the way, she sobered up just about a week or 10 days after me, and in an independent decision from me. She didn't yet know, while I was in treatment, she didn't yet know whether I was going to stop drinking or not, but somehow she arrived at a conclusion that she was done. And she was about almost 3.5-4 years later before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she can tell you what, she can share in her story what that feels like and the effort that it took to get through that time. But we were having trouble, and she wasn't the cause of our trouble, but we were having trouble. We went to a lot of relationships don't survive recovery because we change. We change, and we got to decide what brought us together is no longer going to keep us together. We got to find a new basis for this relationship. And we're seeing this marriage counselor, and we saw her separately before she was seeing us together. And I was in there talking to her. I was prattling along. You know, I knew that she was in recovery, the therapist that I picked out for us, because, well, I tell you now, Connie wasn't the problem. I was convinced then she was the problem. And I was really just giving her a ride to therapy. And and this woman was going to confirm how well I was doing and tweak her up a little bit. And I'm talking to this woman one day, and she just stops me. She said, Steve, you must really be lonely. 3.5 years into Alcoholics Anonymous, loving AA, loving the meetings I'm going to. She said, you must really be lonely. And she had hit upon my secret. She had hit upon that thing. And again, I might not have used that word the moment before she used it, but when she said it, I knew it was true. And it was bone-crushing to me. And I told her she was wrong. I wasn't going to leave there letting her believe that, but I was crushed, and I said, if she's right, if that's true, then this whole AA thing is a sham, and my time here has been a sham, and I'm a fraud. And she said, I bet you're pretty good company, Steve, and I bet people enjoy you at a party, and you go give 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, and then you leave and you're empty. She says, because you're not having true relationships. There's no two-way street with you. And so you just are putting on the act, you leave, and you're empty. And man, she had described it. So I go to my sponsor, and I'm talking to him, and I said, if that's true, then this whole thing's, I'm a fraud, AA's a fraud, what's the deal? And he said, Steve, nothing could be further from the truth. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous has brought you to this point, and now you're ready to put this on the table. Now it's time to deal with this. And as time goes on, there will be more and more. With awareness comes responsibility. And all of a sudden, I had something new to put in the game. And I didn't realize that while not drinking and loving AA, but I was still very much alone, very much in what Butch talked about last night and Chuck C. articulated, that conscious separation from man and God. I am over here. I'm not connected in any meaningful way to people. I'm as connected as I can be, but I don't understand why I don't feel more than I feel. I feel guilty about not feeling bad about things I should feel bad about. I couldn't feel what I thought other people were feeling. 17 minutes if you're counting. I'm going to fast forward a little. I was loving AA. I got a sponsor. My sponsor, Frank, was a wonderful guy. You know, Frank was a character. He was an AA character. He was a bigger-than-life guy. And physically, he was a big man. And I knew right away that in sponsorship, I didn't need somebody to pal around with. I knew that I needed somebody that I viewed as kind of a father figure and that I was a little intimidated by. And I was by Frank. But he was a big book guy, and not a big book thumper. He was a guy who looked for the integrity of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in our literature, and he helped a guy like me and others find that, and as Butch said, put it into application. You know, he said, I wanted to go out into the big discussion meeting when we were having the little big book study, and he said, Steve, come on, man. He said, sit down in here with us for a while. He says, because that's a great meeting out there. He said, there's nothing wrong with discussion meetings. He says, but you want to be familiar enough with this book to know that when you're in that meeting, what they're talking about is Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to be familiar enough with what's in this book to know that when you're sharing in that meeting, what you're sharing is Alcoholics Anonymous, not just a good idea that you had. Which doesn't make it a bad idea. I just don't need to confuse the two. In that hour, I probably should be focused on Alcoholics Anonymous. you know, I'm loving AA, I'm loving this being sober, but there's a little problem. When I bought into having alcoholism, when I read in the book that it said that if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. At a certain point, about 3 weeks into that treatment, I could finally honestly lay my life experience over that and go, that's me, that's true of me. I've got that. And I copped to being alcoholic. And then the very next line said, if so, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. That was bad news for me. I mean, it was, I don't know if I was atheist or agnostic, but at a minimum, I was apathetic. And I was uninvested in the discussion of God or prayer or higher power. And I was really uncomfortable with the conversation. And I spent a fair amount of time early on in AA telling people what I did not believe about God. And finally, a guy came up to me one day. He said, hey, Steve, we don't care what you don't believe. Which was kind of good news, because what he was saying was, you're free not to believe anything you don't want to believe in AA. That's okay. He said, but decide what you do believe and act like a guy would act if he believed it. And there he had hit upon my problem. I didn't believe in anything. I wouldn't hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting when I'm in that treatment center and when we went out to meetings. And the guy came up to me, he said, Steve, what's that all about? And I was earnest. I mean, I was earnest. And I said, look, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I don't know what I believe. And I'm not just going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya with the rest of the campers, because that's what y'all are doing. And this guy had heard my treatment fifth step, you know, which was just kind of a confessional of cathartic puking of every tacky thing that I was willing to share at the time. But there was plenty of it. And he had heard all of that, and he recanted a few of those things back to me. And he says, but hypocrisy is where you draw the line, huh? He said, that's impressive, Steve. That's really, he said, I got good news for you and bad news for you, man. I said, well, I felt condescended to. And if you've ever felt condescended to in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's because you've been condescended to. He said, I got good news for you and bad news for you. I said, I'll play. What's the bad news? He said, the bad news is that hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And I said, what's the good news? And he said, the good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm still really pleased. Yeah, I'm more happy about that today than I was then. But thank goodness, right? That just allowed me to move on just a little bit. See, I'm getting hung up on this God thing, and I will share with you that what I read now in our book, it's been an interesting, slight change of perception. Because it talks about that in our stories, each of us in our own language and from our own point of view talks about how we established a relationship with God. See, what we share with each other is much more about the establishment of the relationship than the relationship. We're talking about the process of the steps that clears away those things that stand between me and that power greater than myself. And I want to get hung up on talking about the understanding, on your understanding versus my understanding. And I don't have to do that anymore. Butch talked about it last night, and it's where I can find a power greater than myself, the way that relationship looks today. When it says no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God, that freed up some time for me. I don't have to do that anymore. Deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I've just decided that that's where God's hanging out. It's just my point of view. But I've decided not only for me, but deep within every man, woman, and child. So where I have been disconnected, that is now my connection point. So now I don't have that conscious separation. That is what binds us together. And that's what makes me one of many. And then it says that I better watch out, that this newfound relationship may be obscured or obstructed by pomp, by worship of other things, and by calamity. And pomp is that reemergence of pride and ego that will block me off from my relationship with this power. worship of other things is anything that I set above that relationship, that money, power, prestige. I get caught up in the world. Those worldly clamors will block me off from that relationship. And calamity. And I know what calamity is. Connie and I, 10 years sober, went bankrupt. We lost our home and had a foreclosure on our home in Richmond, Virginia. They came and picked up our two cars at our house. I called my sponsor, Frank. I said, "Hey, Frank, man, they just took our cars." He said, "No, Steve, they took their cars." They took the cars you quit paying for. But see, that's the, or there might be disease, or there might be the death of a loved one, or there could be a broken relationship. There are real things. There are real big things that happen to us. But a calamity, I've come to believe, is anything that I've decided can't be happening to me. See, when I decide something can't happen and it is happening, life gets real uncomfortable. And Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about having my demands met. It's about lessening my demands. This is about being more and more okay with more and more things, because what I've discovered is all my problems are self-inflicted. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I'm trying to be free of the bondage of self. And these steps are giving me a little more freedom. And sometimes it's okay the way things go. Connie and I were at the, I'm going to tell you a quick story, and then I'll follow it up with Connie and I getting ready to come here Thursday. Years ago, Butch had me up to Toronto, a little conference, one-day thing, and we broke for lunch. And there were a bunch of us sitting at a dinner table, about 10 of us at the table. And they came around and took our order, and I ordered a cheeseburger, and the guy next to me ordered a club sandwich. And we waited a while, and they finally brought our food. They gave me a cheeseburger, and they brought the guy next to me a cheeseburger. And he starts eating the cheeseburger, and I looked over at him. I said, "Man, I thought you ordered a club sandwich." And he said, "I did, but they brought me a cheeseburger." I said, "Brother, you don't have to live like that." I said, "We can get you a club sandwich." And I'm waving people over, because I want to right this horrible wrong. And he said, "No, Steve, I'm good, man." And he wasn't just eating the damned old cheeseburger, because that's what they brought him. He was fine with the cheeseburger. And I can't give it up. You know, I'm still bringing people over. And you know, and it would have been fine, by the way, if when he got that cheeseburger, he said, "You know what, ma'am, I ordered a club sandwich," and they would have gotten him a club sandwich. It would have taken a little bit longer. Would have been anything wrong with that. But wasn't his life easier because he was okay with the cheeseburger? And most of the time, I go through life, you know, ordering a club sandwich and getting a cheeseburger, and it ain't okay. So Thursday morning, Connie and I are in the airport having breakfast, and I ordered, pancakes? And whatever I ordered sausage with it, and they brought bacon. And about halfway through, you know, as we're having the meal, and Connie says, "I thought you ordered sausage." And I said, "I did, but they brought me bacon." Now, had they brought fruit instead of the bacon, that... There's some things you just can't deal with, but my time here in Alcoholics Anonymous is it's about hopefully getting some freedom from that bondage of self, not painting myself into a corner. It's about beginning to see things as they really are. I'd been at a meeting one night in Richmond at 3 or 4 years sober, and I shared for quite some time, almost as long as I have today, and it wasn't a speaker meeting. My sponsor, Joe, I called him when I got home. Joe had been in that meeting, and I said, "Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting?" And he said, "Oh, Steve," he said, "you're still asking all the wrong questions, man." He said, "Because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous?" Because he said, "The truth is, you don't care whether you were self-righteous or not," he says, "but you're afraid they think you're self-righteous." See, I spend all my time worrying about what I think you think about me. And I make life-changing decisions about what I think you think about me. Yet I'm almost always wrong about what you actually think about me. So I'm aiming at the wrong target all the time. And so what you guys have encouraged me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous by giving me a design for living is you've given me the directions. You've encouraged me to act on principle, not on how I feel. When we say that what other people think of us is none of our business, that doesn't mean I don't care what you think. I care what you think. I am not as likely to compromise my behavior based on what I think you think. What you encourage me to do is act on this principle, and the conclusions you draw about me based on that is out of my control. What I've discovered is when I am authentically who I am, frankly, the people that are supposed to be drawn to me in my life are drawn to me in my life. The reason our book says that we can't have a true relationship with another person is because I never bring me to the relationship. If I can't be authentic, then how can I have an authentic relationship? If I can't relax and be who I am, man, that's what I want. See, any moment, any day, I can fall back into that actor wearing two faces, the stage character. Because, as we've said many times over the weekend, I'm going to come nowhere near perfect adherence to these principles. But, man, on those days when I can just relax and be authentically who I am, and that's what I believe these steps are designed to do, and that's what I believe that God within. When we go through these steps, when we look at in that inventory to identify, face, and be rid of those things within ourselves which had been blocking us, I am blocked off that God within then can begin to show up and I can be who I am and begin to live in the real world. Wear this thing literally like a loose garment as we talk about. I called Joe, my brother and I were moving into an office building. We'd bought this little building. It wasn't a high rise, don't get confused, okay? We bought a little building, we're moving a few little things in there, and we're buying some office equipment. And we said, this would be a good time to buy some furniture for our homes. You know, if you need something, buy something, big screen TV, because we'll get the tax advantages of buying it through the business. And I wasn't even conflicted. I was only 15 years sober, and... I mean, I didn't even register. We were excited. I'm talking to Joe, and Joe said, you know, Steve, I don't think I would do that. I mean, he really wasn't telling me not to do it. He said, I don't think I'd be comfortable doing that. And I said, well, Joe, I know it sounds a little bit like tax fraud. And he said, no, Steve, it is tax fraud. See, that's sponsorship. It's not a first cousin to tax fraud, Steve. That's actually fraudulent. He said, look, in Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, do what you're going to do, man. He says, I'm not going to love you any less. We're not kicking you out of the club. He said, I'm not in charge of where everybody's moral line is. He said, so do what you're going to do. But don't kid yourself about what you're doing. And that's what you guys have said. Says, you know, we're going to live our lives. We're going to make mistakes. I don't quit making mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys just asked me to stand in front of them. And see, and when we're our best, that's why we got to be careful not to eat our young. When we stumble and fall in Alcoholics Anonymous, the response is to help people up. If I can't make a mistake here, where am I going? If I can't learn to grow through my mistakes here, where can I? The most dangerous thing that I do, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was comforted early on by the anonymity, as I understood, the anonymity that you don't know who I am. You don't have the backstory on me, so I can relax in your meeting. Nothing's expected of me. It was comfortable. It was the most comfortable hour of my day. And then I stay at AA for a little while, and I get back into image management in AA. Which is a total waste of time. I mean, I've looked around this room. Who wants to impress this crowd, really? I mean, it's a total short bus group. And but we do, you know, because, you know, because, see, I think that's the, I don't quit being human. I loved what Cliff said yesterday, you know, when he says, you know, we get sober, I still get wet when it rains, you know. I'm not unaffected by life. But you just want, encourage me to stand up in front of it, to take it on, to spot, admit my and correct my mistakes as I go along. And this is a place, you know, there's no place I've ever been. I don't think that we are special people. We're graced, we're fortunate, we're lucky, but we get confused in AA sometimes thinking we're better than folks that aren't in AA. You know, we start talking about, I wish they had a program. Jesus. But you know what? I'm so glad I've got a program. And I'm so glad that I found my way to Alcoholics Anonymous and not through virtue and not through intelligence. And I'm so glad on those good days when I'm applying these steps in my life, when, as Butch said, I'm putting in, taking the information and putting it into application, which brings about the transformation, that I'm having a real life experience with real life people. And you promised me that you would remove the obsession to drink through the process of these steps, this God often acting through you. And that the result would be that I would have a life which is happily and usefully whole. I think the most important thing that's happened for me today, and other people have talked about it, is I have a life that is purposeful. See, what you've done by inviting Connie and I here this weekend, we're not confused. I'm certainly not confused that you need to hear what I have to say. But man, I'm a guy that's got an overwhelming need to say it. So I'm so glad you've given me that opportunity. I'm going to close by telling you what God looks like in my life today, because it's from a short poem that a man in Nashville, Mo H., used to say when he shared his, anytime he shared his talks. And the first time I heard it now, 18, 19 years ago, I knew he had summed up in about three lines what my experience had been in AA. And Mo contracted cancer, and shortly before his passing, my friend Jerry and I went and had breakfast with him. And it turned out to be 6 weeks before he passed away. But I asked Mo that morning, I said, Mo, would you mind, when I get a chance to share my story, if I close with the verse to that poem? Because it has meant so much to me. And he said, oh, Steve, he was a little embarrassed. You know, he said, oh, Steve, if you think it'll help another drunk. Because that's the kind of AA member Mo was. He loved alcoholics, wet or dry. He loved alcoholics. Sometimes a guy like me can get to Alcoholics Anonymous about a half hour later. I love AA, but I'm not too crazy about alcoholics. Wet or dry, new perennial slipper comes in the door. I'm looking down. I'm getting coffee. I'm hoping he doesn't come over and bug me again. I've already, you know, and Mo's running to the guy, giving him a kiss and a hug and say, we love you and we're glad you're back. And I look at that and go, man, where have I been? That's the kind of man I want to be. That's the kind of AA member I want. Anyway, Mo had said this poem, and the poem is simply, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. See, when I couldn't find a God, when I couldn't develop this relationship with my fellow man, with a God, you guys started sharing your life with me. And you invited me to share my life with you. And in that process, this power shows up in a way that I can't define or comprehend. And has indeed offered me a life which is happily and usefully whole. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.